everybody. It's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
The True Crime Society podcast contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
If you'd like to skip the intro, please refer to the timestamp listed in the episode description. Thank you.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another True Crime Society. Like, what am I saying? I didn't say welcome back. That's why. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the True Crime Society podcast with Stephanie and Olivia. It is May 30th, 2024 right now. I was trying to think of what to talk about, and I was trying to think of things that annoyed me today, and I have one, thankfully, for everyone. I know you're all so happy. So you know what I hate? When you go on Facebook on like your phone or whatever, or on the computer, and the first thing right at the top is some like cringe memory from 13 years ago or something. It makes me so mad. And I really wish I could shut it off. Like, I've looked for ways to just turn off memories, and there's no way. If anyone's found a way, let me know, because I had a Facebook first when I was in ninth grade, 16-ish. And some of the stuff I posted is so embarrassing. Like, and I just immediately delete it. But I never choose to go and look at my memories.
I went the other day. I like, because I feel like I wish Instagram, like, see, I'm the opposite. I like to see the memories. But like, I went on my archive on Instagram the other day, and we were just talking about it. It's a year since I was in New York. So I was looking at all the memories of that. That's cool. But I do agree. All
the, I like the more recent ones.
Yeah, not the really old stuff.
No, when I see something where it's like in 2006, you posted this, and it's like a rap lyric or something. I don't know. That was just like the age of everyone posting all their fucking business online as if anyone cared, because it was like new and exciting.
Have you seen the meme? And it's like, there's no one I have less in common with than me on my Facebook status in 2012 or whatever.
Yeah, it's so, I'm like sick about it. And they do have a setting. I think only really I can see it, or maybe my friends, but there is a setting where you can make it so other people can't like search your Facebook that far back. So like, thank God. But I'm like, I don't need to remember any of this. Like, I loved posting a quote, a Taylor Swift quote, lyric, anything like that. So embarrassing. Now, even though I have a small following on Instagram, where I'm like, people would probably care if I posted more or want to see what I'm up to if they follow me and like the podcast. But now I'm like, so embarrassed to even post anything. I'm like, who do I think I am posting about my day on my Instagram?
didn't they used to have like a prompting? Because now it says like, right, I don't know what it says, like, right, you're feeling or whatever. But didn't it used to say like, Olivia is? And so you'd be like, Olivia is. Like, it would have a prompt of like, that's why people's statuses were different.
No, it like didn't have the is, but it was because of MySpace, because that's how it was on MySpace, I think. So then on Facebook, everyone just started writing like, is. Because I'll see old ones that are like, is having a great day. So then like, Stephanie Summer is having a great day.
Oh my God. Memories.
Yeah.
And I guess now Facebook has been around for so long that there are really a lot of memories on there. Not all great.
That's what I mean. It's been like my whole teen young adult existence, where now I don't post as much on Facebook because it's like died out more. But all of my growing up years are on Facebook. And I had so many old like Facebook albums from, you know, when you'd have one night out with your friends and you'd post an album of like 50 pictures, maybe a two-parter because you were only allowed to post 50 pictures.
You might even have to upload it from your actual camera, like your point-and-shoot camera.
Of course. Yeah. And one day I'm so thankful I went through and I made all of them the privacy settings to only me, because I was like, people are not seeing me drinking as like an 11th grader in high school. Get out of here.
So funny.
My MySpace, I deleted it. I couldn't get on it anymore. They had a thing where you could send in your ID and they'd delete it for you. And I did that, which I'm very grateful for. But sometimes I'm like, man, I wish that I could like go back and look, just because, not to like bring down the mood, but some of my friends, like my best friend from growing up and my first like real boyfriend that I dated for years, they both passed away. And sometimes I'm like, man, I wish I could go back and see like what pictures are on there that didn't make it to Facebook because it was like before that time. But I'm also like, thank God, because if I think what I posted on Facebook is cringe, MySpace was probably 10 times worse.
I do wish, like, I'd love to just go back and have a look just for a minute. And even I used to have a live journal back in the day. I can't even remember what the URL was, but
yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm probably glad about that.
Yeah, I had a Zanga. I'm like, what would I even write about? Because apparently I just wrote everything on MySpace and Facebook anyways. Anyways. Anything exciting going on with you now that I've just randomly talked about the most random nostalgia ever?
Not really. There might be another car update, possibly. We went and test drove the new car, or ate the same as the new car this week. It is apparently on a boat meant to arrive from Asia in the country on 5th of June. So the guy reckons we will have it by the end of June, fingers crossed. Or obviously that's dependent on weather and I guess how quickly the boat can get here. But hopefully this car saga is almost over. I think we signed for our first lemon car on like the 27th of June last year because we had to wait 6 months for it to arrive. God. So a year this has been coming.
Almost a year.
Almost a year. Well, it probably will be almost exactly a year when we pick up the new car. So anyway.
It's funny because we were just talking on Patreon and we were talking about this the other day too between amongst ourselves, is that it's almost my wedding anniversary and how it feels like literally the fastest year ever. But then thinking of your car thing, it feels like that's been going on for years. Like, oh, literally forever.
And even like when I, like, I think we only got the refund for the car in March, so it's been like only 2 months since that. I'm like, gosh, that feels like a lifetime ago that that all happened.
Crime update, it'll be old news now. There'll probably be more information about it when this episode comes out. Chad Daybell guilty.
Yeah.
On all counts, really. So that is good. Now we wait to find out if he'll get the death penalty or not.
The court is directed that the defendant would be sentenced to death on those counts.
Chad Daybell sat emotionless as a jury of his peers sealed his fate. And this morning, the so-called doomsday author sentenced to death after being convicted in the 2019 murders of his first wife, Tammy Daybell, and his second wife's two children, 16-year-old Tylee Ryan and 7-year-old Joshua J.J. Vallow.
These are the charges he was found guilty on. Conspiracy to commit murder of Tylee, first-degree murder of Tylee, conspiracy to commit murder of J.J., first-degree murder of J.J., conspiracy to commit murder of Tammy, first-degree murder of Tammy. Tammy was his first wife. And insurance fraud for Tylee, J.J., and Tammy's benefits. So
I'm happy for all the families for getting justice, but especially like Tammy's family, because at first her death was just ruled weird, accidental, yeah. Who knows? And then it reopened, and now they're finally getting justice. Because I'm sure they always thought that he did something, that him and Lori did something.
In this case, there are a lot of kids left behind. Like, Chad and Lori both had other children who are now, I guess, left to, A, be associated with this disgusting legacy and then pick up the pieces of their lives, which I feel like a lot of the times those survivors, I guess, are forgotten. And I just can't even imagine having to deal with, A, the grief of losing your siblings, your parents, and then to deal with all this other junk on top of it would be so much for them to deal with.
Yeah, definitely. So anyways, today we're going to talk about another older case. I feel like we're going to try to throw in some older cases because we usually do more current ones, and then like every so often we would do an older one. We're going to try mixing up a little and do some older ones as well. So if you guys have any you want to hear us talk about that haven't been covered 8,000 times. Well, I mean, this one's been covered a lot, but also not.
And I feel like too, when we do older ones, I like there's a new generation of true crime followers coming in who may not be aware of them, whereas we just kind of assume that maybe, you know, people are over them. But all the older ones that we've done recently have done really well. You guys seem to be into them. So yeah, it's exciting to do a deep dive into some older cases. And the one plus for us is that there's usually a lot of information online that we can find about it, whereas the newer cases sometimes isn't quite as much. So
we're definitely still going to do current ones, but it just seems like there hasn't been anything like too crazy happening either.
Yeah.
So today we're going to talk about Ray Rivera. So this was in Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix, but apparently that left out a ton of information and might have been pretty...
They took a lot of liberties.
Had a lot of confirmation bias.
They actually, like, some of it, I feel like, because I love Unsolved Mysteries. It's probably my favorite show of all time. And this was in the new Unsolved Mysteries, the, like, reboot, which I think they're making another season this year. But when I started doing the notes for this, a lot of it is actually just plain false in the Unsolved Mysteries. Like, they just, I feel like they do it for sensationalism and to kind of boost the angle that they're going with in the story, which we'll talk about in this one. But
yeah,
interesting that a lot of it wasn't true.
They only present the facts that go with the most sensational theory, like sometimes.
Alison Rivera has gone without answers about the death of her husband, Ray, for 14 years. It was May 2006. 32-year-old Ray Rivera's body was found in a meeting room of the Belvedere Hotel. A hole in the roof suggested he fell from a height. Mystery has prevailed ever since.
I kept saying there is something bigger. I'm going to find out.
This month sparked new interest in the case. The Netflix series, Unsolved Mysteries, featured the Ray Rivera case in its opening episode.
It's truly unbelievable.
It was the first time Allison spoke so publicly about her loss and frustration of not knowing what led to Ray's death.
Somebody has, there's an answer out there. Somebody knows something. And if that's just seeing him or the phone call that was made, there's an answer out there. And I thought that this would be a platform in which just lay the facts out and see if there's, you know, somebody out there that knows something.
Baltimore police in 2006 quickly leaned to suicide. But the medical examiner left the case open with a ruling of undetermined.
So all of our sources for this will be on our blog. As always, there's a blog called CalebKaltenbach.com that has a lot of comprehensive information on this case. So a lot of this info comes from there. As some background into Ray, he was born Ray Omar Rivera on June 10th, 1973. His parents were Angel and Maria Rivera. Ray was born in Madrid, Spain, but his parents moved him and his siblings, he has a brother and a sister, to the U.S. when he was young. He grew up in Southern California and Florida. In 1995, Ray graduated from the University of the Pacific. He went on to play water polo for the Royal Federation of Water Polo in Spain. From 1998 to 2001, Ray coached water polo at a high school in Burbank, California, and he enjoyed writing screenplays as well. When Ray was around 30 years old, he met his future wife, Allison. Around this time, in September 2004, one of Ray's friends from high school, Porter Stansberry, offered him a job. Porter had started a financial planning organization called Stansberry Research. Ray's job was to write a financial newsletter for the company called The Rebound Report, where he recommended stocks. Ray and Allison moved from California to Baltimore, Maryland. They bought a house, found a new church, and began to plan their wedding. And they agreed to try to live in Baltimore for 2 years. Three significant events happened in a very short period for Ray between November and December 2005. So within like a month or two. Ray and Allison got married in November 2005 in Puerto Rico. One of his friends, Tom Hickling, was killed in a car wreck while on vacation in Africa. Allison would later say that Ray was suspicious of how the wreck happened, but that he wouldn't share any of his concerns with her. After their wedding, Ray left his job at Stansberry Research. He started coaching water polo for Johns Hopkins University, and he began working on another screenplay. He also launched his own small production company called Seba Video Production. He took a $15,000 cash advance from Allison's credit card company to buy equipment.
So they were the three things that happened essentially between November and December. So a very small amount of time to get married, change your job, have a friend pass away. Like, there was a lot going on.
Mm-hmm. And just like starting a new business and suddenly getting that much debt, that's like a big ongoing stressor.
Stress, yeah.
So like we said, there is an Unsolved Mysteries episode on this case. And if you've seen it, it states that Ray was still employed by Porter Stansberry at the time of his death. But we think he resigned not long after his wedding.
The Unsolved Mysteries episode definitely goes with the angle that Porter Stansbury's company mate. Like, there was some relation to Ray's death and the company, which is why I think they said he was still employed. Obviously, we'll discuss it more as we go on, but that's, I feel like, why they kept that part of the story in there.
So this info about the name of Ray's company is from Reddit, and there's an entire subreddit about Ray Rivera. There's a ton of info on it, so you could check that out if you want to as well. So this is that info. It says, the name of Ray's company is worth noting, that Ceiba is a tree with spiritual meaning. It is believed that the souls of the dead ascend to the top of the tree to go to heaven. There's also some connection between all three worlds, the underworld, earth, and heaven. Interesting.
Kind of maybe gives you an insight into his thought process at the time. He seems like he was a very spiritual person, and he dug deep on a lot of things, which that, like, that kind of thing also leads me to believe that that is the type of person that he was.
Yeah. After Ray launched his production company, several companies contracted him to make videos for their clients. One of these was the Oxford Club, which was owned by a parent organization called the Agora. Stansbury Research was also owned by the Agora. So after their wedding in spring 2006, Ray and Allison went back to California for a visit and started to plan to move back there. They returned to Maryland, and it's reported that they put their house up for sale, and Allison said that Ray seemed stressed. So yeah, another stressful thing.
Yeah.
Allison has said that Ray insisted on going everywhere with her, almost as if he was protecting her. She said that one day she went for a jog at a track near their home, and Ray insisted on accompanying her. It sounds like he didn't want her to jog. He just sat in the stands and watched. Another man entered the track while Allison was jogging, and Ray got up and ran towards the man, and the man quickly left the area. Side note, just kind of funny how it's like he was going everywhere with her as if he was protecting her. Where as a girl, I'm always trying to get Mike to go everywhere with me because I'm like afraid after all the true crime stuff we go through. And just as a woman in general, I feel like you're more susceptible to be attacked, especially on your own. Because sometimes I'm like, I want to go for like a jog or a run outside or go to the bike path by myself. And then I'm like, but I'm scared. So Allison also said that she could tell something was bothering Ray, but he wouldn't tell her what it was. On May 14th, Ray and Allison went to church. And when they got home, Allison heard Ray make a call and leave a message to Porter saying, hey, man, give me a call back. I finally got it all figured out. The entire time they were living in Baltimore, their home security alarm went off twice. The first time was on Monday, May 15th, 2006 at 1 a.m. And Allison said that she woke up and saw that Ray was not in their bed. She went downstairs and Ray came out with a baseball bat. Allison said he had a look of terror on his face that she'd never seen before. The police arrived at the home and checked out the area. They told Allison and Ray that perhaps a squirrel triggered the alarm. I don't think it's weird to be terrified when your alarm goes off at 1 a.m. And I mean, they do malfunction sometimes because growing up we had one that sometimes it would just go off for like no reason. And I remember it was always really scary because you were like, oh no, is someone breaking in?
It's kind of interesting because from what I read, it seems like Ray heard the alarm and went downstairs, but he didn't realize that it was Allison coming down the stairs. Like, he almost came at her with the baseball bat, which I understand too, because you would not know who's in the house. But just kind of, an interesting scenario.
Were they not sleeping in bed together when it went off? Because you would think like they'd both wake up and be like, oh my God, what's that? Why is the alarm going off? Or was he already like working or something? Or was he sleeping on the couch?
I just kind of read it as if she woke up and he'd already left the bed, but maybe he hadn't been to bed. It's an interesting thought.
Well, just because I feel like...
Yeah, I agree. Like even like if like our smoke alarm aware of her being battery awake. Beeps or whatever, we're like, what is that? Like you wake up. Yeah, if you would hear it at the same time, you would think if you were in the bed together.
Then he wouldn't be so like ready to attack her because he's like, I know she's awake and going to come downstairs probably. So the alarm went off again the following night, Tuesday, May 16th, around 1 a.m. Allison has said that Ray looked even more terrified than the night before. She said that the living room windows appeared to have been damaged from the outside, but there wasn't any fingerprints found on the windows. They say what kind of damage, like screen cut?
No, I've read like tampered with is another word they use.
Maybe it meant like the screen looked like someone tried to pull it out or something.
I don't know. But then I think I've read too that it was kind of too smudged for them to get fingerprints. Not that there wasn't any, like there might have been, but like the surface of the windows and what was on them, I guess, was too hard for them to determine if there were any clear fingerprints.
So police went to the house again, and again, they suggested that maybe an animal had made the alarm go off. Later that morning, Allison had to leave for a 3 to 4 day business trip. Reg walked Allison out of the house and they had the following exchange. She said, "I love you so much," to which he replied, "Thank you for loving me so much." I'd be like, "Do you love me too? Hello?" After Allison left, Ray did some work. He booked an editing suite for the next weekend so that he could finish off a project for one of the Agora's companies. He also apparently made a call to a Freemason representative and had a discussion believed to be about a screenplay idea. At some point around this time, Ray also purchased a Freemasons for Dummies book.
We will speak a bit about Freemasons in this episode. If you're not familiar with what that is, basically a definition I found online, because there's a lot of very complex definitions. This one's quite simple.
That's why I'm always confused.
Yeah. It says a Freemason is a member of an international order established for mutual help and fellowship, which sometimes hold elaborate secret ceremonies. There's another one basically that says Freemasonry is a fraternal organization of men who believe in brotherhood and helping others. Its members are known as Freemasons. And it says Freemasons can also help one another in times of hardship, and it exists in various forms all over the world. So basically,
is it like New World Order type stuff, or is that something else? I had to take a conspiracy class in college. Somehow this was like a writing course, and we had to read a book about like the New World Order type thing, like Illuminati stuff. And I feel like,
well, I was going to say, is it Illuminati?
Try to bring up Freemasons.
So I feel like basically because there's a lot of secrecy behind the Freemasons and what they do, people just assume. I feel like in this case, Ray seems interested in Freemasons possibly because of this screenplay that he was writing, but it's just an interesting side note after we know what happened.
One of Allison's co-workers, Claudia, arrived at Ray and Allison's home that day. I also think this is weird. She was going to spend the night there because, you know, Allison was away for this work trip. So for some reason, her friend was like spending the night there.
Yeah. And especially for a work trip, like you would think that your work would pay for you to be in a hotel or something. Like I did find this a bit weird too, and I haven't really seen much clarified about it, but maybe they were just close friends. And she's like, "Hey, stay here instead." And I don't know.
Oh, she was traveling for work too?
So oh, Claudia... co-worker. It was Allison's co-worker who was in Baltimore for work. So she wasn't from that area. So she basically they were traveling on kind of opposite schedules. So Allison left and Claudia arrived and decided to stay at their house when she was also traveling for work.
I was just assuming it was someone who, one of her co-workers that like lived there also. And I was like, why is she having her stay at her house? Like, did she feel like Ray was acting weird and needed to have someone keep an eye on him?
From everything I've read is that basically she needed a place to stay. I don't know. Maybe she did live in the area and there was a reason she couldn't stay at her apartment. Like, I don't know, whatever the reason was. But yeah, it's I have always found that an interesting part of the story.
And it's like, were her and Ray close? Because I'm like, I'd rather stay in a hotel than like,
yeah, with your friend's husband alone.
So it'd be like if Mike went away for work and then one of his coworkers was just going to stay at the house. Like, I feel like that'd be weird for both of us.
It'd be so awkward.
I'd be like, no, it's fine. I'll pay the $400 for the hotel. So around 6:30 p.m., Claudia was in the guest room and Ray was working in his office, which was next to that room. And Claudia said that Ray got a call on his cell phone. She heard Ray yell, "Oh shit," after he answered the phone. And then he rushed out of the house in flip-flops and drove away in Allison's car. He then came back briefly, ran into the house for some unknown reason, and then drove away again. The call was later found to have originated from the Agora switchboard. Porter Stansberry has denied that anyone would have called Ray. Quote from him is, "Every person or company who had worked with Ray was on the Eastern Shore at the time the call was made, having a corporate retreat in St. Michael's. No one in my company was in town when Ray disappeared. The idea we were calling him from our switchboard is ridiculous," which I think is also just like a weird comment being like, no one would ever call him.
So like it could have been another company because the Agora is kind of like the head company. Stansberry Research was under that umbrella. So there were other companies and we know that Ray was doing work for the Oxford Group, I think it was called. Like, so it could have come from another company, but it's, yeah, a weird denial from Porter Stansberry.
Allison tried to call Ray multiple times that night and he never answered. She said that was out of character for him, and she ended up going to bed just assuming maybe he was out with friends or something. Claudia called Allison the next morning to say that Ray never came home, and she also said that all the lights were still on downstairs and in his office. So Allison again tried to contact him, and at this point she was very worried. She cut her trip short and went back to Baltimore. Allison contacted their friends, family, and colleagues, and nobody had heard from him. When Allison got back to their home, Ray still hadn't returned. His computer was on the kitchen counter, along with his Invisalign, some chips, and the drink that he'd been drinking. So I guess the point of that is to say it seemed like he left in a hurry. He was literally eating chips and having a drink and just like left.
It's interesting to me, though, because Claudia said he got the call in the study, which was next to the guest room. But I don't know, I guess there could be reasons for that. She's saying that all his stuff was found on the kitchen counter as if he'd been working there, but then the call he got was in the guest room. So
maybe he like walked to the guest room.
Yeah, I don't know.
While he was on the phone.
I don't know. It's very weird.
Allison called Ray's parents and siblings, and they also traveled to Baltimore to help search. Allison turned their home into like a search headquarters, and she discovered there'd been no activity on his cell phone or his bank account since he'd left the home. She, along with friends and family, searched the neighborhood and other areas in Baltimore. Porter Stansberry offered a financial reward and hired a private investigator and contacted the media. During the search, Porter told a journalist that Ray was a happy guy. He and his wife just booked a trip to go to New Mexico in a few weeks. This is not a man that wanted to leave. I've got to find my friend. I can't imagine my life without him. He's my best friend. I thought it was interesting that considering this guy is like a big company owner who seems pretty rich, it was a $1,000 reward.
Yeah. I guess $1,000 was probably, it still would have only been the equivalent of maybe $5,000 or so. But yeah, it's quite a small reward for someone who seems to be quite wealthy.
Yeah. Especially like, is someone going to admit to a crime or get involved for $1,000? On May 22nd, 2006, Allison's parents were driving around downtown Baltimore trying to find the car that Ray left in. By some miracle, they spotted it in a downtown parking lot near a building called the Belvedere. The building was a hotel at one point, but now has apartments, restaurants, and bars. I think that you could live there at the time, though, even though it was a hotel, because the woman who wrote, there's a book about this, yeah. She said she lived there. I don't know if maybe it was like extended stay or something. The parking lot where the car was found was close to Ray's workplace. There was a ticket on the SUV that showed the vehicle had been there since May 16th, which was when Ray ran out of the house in his flip-flops. An employee at the parking lot said that the SUV was not there when he left on May 16th, but that it was there when they got to work on the morning of Tuesday, May 17th. So it seems like it was later at night, I would guess, then.
Yeah, sounds like it.
The search for Ray moved to the area near where the car was found. On May 24th, some of Ray's colleagues spent their break looking for him because it was near the office. They went to the top of the parking garage next to the Belvedere that overlooked the building connected to the Belvedere, and they looked over the ledge and spotted a narrow and small hole on the second floor of the building. Surrounding the hole were flip-flops, a cell phone, a set of keys, and glasses. Ray's colleagues called the police. Police determined that the hole was in a conference room that was hardly ever used. When the police went to the room and opened the door, there was a horrible smell. The hole acted like a skylight into the room, and Ray's severely damaged body was sprawled under the hole in direct sunlight, and he'd been laying there for over a week when he was found, so he'd started to decompose. Ray was taken to the medical examiner's office for an autopsy.
So we have his whole autopsy on our blog. I think it's like 7 pages long. I've just picked out some parts that I believe are most important for the story, but you can read the whole thing if you want. It says, the body was that of a well-developed, well-nourished, moderately decomposed Hispanic male clad, and it goes into what he was wearing. It says, the body weighed 251 pounds, was 6'4", and appeared compatible with the age of 32. So it like basically says things like a faint scar appearing to be a circle with a line through it on the right hip. There were no needle tracks. Basically, it doesn't sound like there's anything unexpected based on the condition of the body and how long it had been there. This is a list of all the injuries that the body had. It says, A, head and neck injuries. There was an abrasion and laceration of the forehead, fractures of the maxilla, zygomatic bones and mandible, avulsion of mandibular teeth, multiple skull fractures, multiple base of skull fractures, and 3 hemorrhages are listed. In terms of his torso, there was contusion of the chest, abrasions of the torso, bilateral clavicle fractures, fractures of the sternum, multiple rib fractures. He had lots of lacerations in his heart. lung contusions, lacerations of the lungs, liver, right groin. His right pelvis was fractured and he had a hemorrhage in his testicle. And in terms of extremity injuries, it says abrasions of the upper and lower extremities, lacerations of the lower extremities, fracture of the right tibia and the fibula. And the medical examiner gives their opinion on the cause of death. It says Ray died as injuries sustained as a result of precipitation from a 13-story building. According to the investigation, he had been missing for approximately 1 week and was discovered moderately decomposed in a locked conference room on the second floor. And then it goes into all the injuries. And it says, because of the circumstances surrounding the incident are unclear, it is not known how the deceased came to have precipitated from such a height. The manner of death is best classified as undetermined. Alcohol detected in the decomposition fluid may be entirely or in part due to decomposition, and toxicology for drugs was negative. So basically his injuries caused his death, but they don't know how he came to sustain those injuries. Police began to look into how Ray could have ended up in the conference room. There was a very large distance between the hole and between the hotel and the location of the hole. It's thought that Ray would have had to have run at a speed of 10 miles an hour to kind of make the jump from the hotel through the roof. That is classed as a fast run and a sprint for a male wearing sport shoes. And Ray was either barefoot or wearing flip-flops. I assume he was still wearing the flip-flops because they were found with his body. But
I saw on Reddit, I was like reading about it quickly just to see what other people were thinking. And people said in that book that apparently has a ton of information from the person who lived there at the time and then, you know, obviously did their own research and everything. They said that the flip-flops were found on the roof and that the police actually threw them down. So, I mean, I don't know what's true, but that's another thing that is said as well, which, I mean, not to get ahead, but I mean, could make sense they'd be on the roof if the theory you go with is that he did run and jump, because maybe to run fast enough he would have had to kick those off.
Interesting. But they said for him to get into the hole where he entered it, he would have had to have a maximum run up of 15 feet or 5 meters in 2.5 seconds, which, you know, I guess it's not totally impossible, but it, as they said, between a fast run and a sprint. So this
does really try.
Yeah, this does indicate that Ray likely willingly went off the roof. He couldn't have accidentally fallen because he essentially wouldn't have got that much air before he fell, or he wasn't pushed or thrown because you couldn't throw him that far. There is also the possibility that Ray could have jumped from a lower ledge, but the balconies and ledges there were from privately owned buildings or from an office that had a window on the ledge. So they're saying for him to have jumped from a public area, that's probably where he would have jumped from, or, you know, whatever happened to him, it happened in that public area. Ray's phone was found with some scratches on it, but it wasn't broken and it was still working. His money clip that Alice in the City always carried with him was not found and it has never been found. Shortly after Ray was found, Porter apparently became uncooperative. This information is from the subreddit for Ray. It says he does not return the homicide detective's calls, and when the detective tries to contact the employees in the office, he's told by company lawyers that employees are not authorized to speak with him. Porter also spoke to Allison and told her he doesn't want to speak to police and fears they will be against him due to his prior SEC investigation. He hired a publicist and they denied, though, that any gag order was ever placed on any employees by Porter. So kind of an interesting contradiction, because he apparently told them not to talk, but the publicist is saying that never happened. Allison hired a private investigator. She and the PI went to the Belvedere to review the CCTV. There was apparently no footage for May 16th. There was footage for May 15th and 17th, but nothing for the 16th. There was apparently a protect button in this CCTV system, which was located on a keyboard in the concierge area, and there was also another button on a computer in the back end. So if that button was hit, basically that footage is disabled or deleted or unable to be viewed. Police have said they took the hard drives, though, for investigation. While she was searching their house for more information after the death, Allison found a bizarre note that was folded up in plastic and had been taped to Ray's computer screen along with a blank check. The note had been typed in tiny print. The Baltimore Police Commander, Fred Bielfield, said it just seemed bizarre, really bizarre. We have a photo of the note, which we'll post on our social media, but basically they've got a ruler there, so it looks like maybe 3/4 of the length of a ruler or something like that. It's a tiny little font. It's been in almost, it's like he's cut it out into a specific shape. It's kind of just very strange. Officials found it so strange that police sent it to the FBI. They examined it and said it wasn't a suicide note. Former police commander Mel Blizzard also reviewed it and agreed. He said, what it does appear to be is a weird stream of conscious writing. The only thing I thought of, if he's writing some code to someone about something, and that's possible. So there are some different transcripts online. I found one which I think is probably the most complete and most likely. It's no one knows exactly 100% what the note says, but I'll read out what we do know so far, and we'll post it on the blog and the Instagram if you want to read it. But it starts with, brothers and sisters, right now around the world volcanoes are erupting. What an awesome sight. And then he writes some Latin, which I won't attempt to butcher, but it means whom virtue unites, death will not separate. He goes on, that was a well-played game. Congratulations to all who participated. I hope you enjoyed it. But it was time to wake up, so here I am. I'd like to welcome those who accepted our invitations for membership during the game. We couldn't have done it without you. I took on this endeavor to find the truth, but not for its own sake in accepting this quest for the truth. I hope to make myself, with the help of others, into a man worthy and ready to receive it. Members of the council, please note that I would lend careful consideration to the traditional responsibilities in light of these proceedings, and I will satisfy the standard request of the council within the appropriate time. Again, well done to all who participated. I expect the council has invited all the players who gave their lives to this pursuit back, so they may join us there. Then it says, fare thee well, Rob Rosenberg. Before I continue with my instructions for the council and claim the prize for my service, I'd like to allow Porter Stansberry to claim his prize. Now, Porter, and then there's three words which aren't able to be read, by claiming something I'll just take back. He says, now the game is finished, I expect the council to, another word that can't be read, to something those who have given something to this venture. Along with myself, these players should be made 5 years younger by the council. It says, so then he goes on to list Porter Stansberry as one of the people. And he says, brothers and sisters, our land of attachments has seen many ideas become new since my game began. And this is where he goes on to list a whole bunch of kind of random things, I guess, that have become new since whatever game he was playing has started. Radio frequency identification, digital music players, portable or otherwise, CD, VCD, DVD, HDTV, the human genome, genetic engineering, cloning, Sudoku, Viagra, the fuel cell, overnight express shipping, Wi-Fi, internet, Ethernet, Bluetooth, JPEG, MP3, Invisalign, which is interesting because he did have his Invisalign on the table when he left, the Da Vinci surgical robot, and muscle milk. He said, the rights, patents, and proceeds for all of them should have been transferred to me by now. I know that Porter Stansberry has created a way for you to do so. For future transactions, you should visit me at any of the properties that I resume control of. My biggest residence, which includes a beautiful piece of property in northern Argentina, and I'm told the biggest mansion in Buenos Aires. Well done, Porter. In Europe, you can visit me at the flat in Nice or in Madrid, although if I'm in Spain, I'll probably be at the castle. In Asia, you'll be able to find me in Thailand. Another job well done, Porter. I will keep two houses in California and the house in San Francisco, although I'll be looking for a new place in Baltimore and perhaps some other cities. I'd like to briefly mention some movies, books, and music I found very inspiring and compelling. I'd love to meet any of you who help contribute to these works. So then he goes on to list a lot of movies. The Matrix 1, 2, and 3, The Family Man, National Treasure, The Da Vinci Code, Eyes Wide Shut, Confessions of a Dance Floor, Demon Days, 10 Summoner's Tales, November Rain, Home by Now, The Animators, Meet Joe Black, Minority Report, Star Wars 1 to 3, Lord of the Rings 1 to 3, Fight Club 7, The Game, and Paycheck. Then he goes on to say, and specifically let me say that I expect M. Night Shyamalan to continue coming up with great ideas and making great movies. I particularly enjoyed his movies, Wide Awake, The Sixth Sense, The Village, The Others, Signs, and Unbreakable. He goes on to say, I'd also like to single out a name. You had, and a lot of this is kind of unable to be read, but I'll just make it as coherent as possible. It says, you had a good blank, but what's, I'm assuming it would probably be done is done. The game is up. It's time for some shut eye. In this transcript, there are three paragraphs that the person can't make out, which I'll leave out because it is quite hard. It's easier to read. So check out the blog. It's just a bunch of random words like people everywhere, ultimate goal, progress, different things like that. So Ray finished the note with, take care and enjoy the butterflies. So a very interesting note, quite rambling, it seems to me.
I did find one comment on Reddit today that seems like it could maybe make some sense, albeit still weird. Someone said, the note is not a note, it's mapping for a tone reel. I've been looking over all the comments and I'm shocked that nobody else has mentioned this. Does anybody go to film school? So it's kind of hard to explain. I mean, this is another comment that kind of gives more context into what a tone reel is. I've been talking to my friends from film school about this exact thing. I write up stuff all the time, just like Ray's notes for my own scripts. It's just part of the prep process. You basically write up titles, characters, monologues from the point of view of your characters in a near stream of consciousness. It gives you a handle on what the tone of your script or project moving forward will be. He said, I also hide my prep documents around my office or in various textbooks if I feel like I've got something super juicy, but I don't want anyone to see it just yet. Just like my husband who borrows my office from time to time and who I don't want to always read my mad ramblings. So basically, I guess he is a screenwriter, so it could make sense, kind of just like writing stream of consciousness ideas to get kind of the vibe you're going for. It does still seem pretty chaotic, but I kind of get it. Like, not to be like, oh, I went to school for writing. So like, I do kind of get how that could be a thing. Just getting past writer's block maybe, and just writing ideas and the tone and maybe like some scenes and thoughts you have in your head about it to just try to get started. And I did see some, because it does say like Porter's name in it and stuff like that. And I did see another person comment that instead of trying to like think of names at the time, you just use like names of people you know as placeholders. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's an interesting take, because otherwise I have no idea. Like, the note literally makes no sense. I can't even get through reading it with my attention span, because I'm just like, what is being said here?
It's a lot of rambling. Like, even as I was reading out the notes, I could just feel my eyes kind of glazing over a little bit. Like, I would love to know. Yeah. Obviously, we will never know probably what he meant by it. But
I think that's the only thing that makes kind of sense, is like that stream of consciousness, like idea he had.
I just wonder why
script,
he taped it up, and why the tiny little font. Like, is that just a creative process? I don't know. But it just seems like, it seems to me like a very manic note, and even the way that he wrote it and he left it and the font he used and the like shape of the paper, it just seems like there was a lot going on.
I feel like maybe it could have been like the stream of consciousness thing I was saying, but regardless, I do think he was struggling mentally at the time, so maybe that is kind of why it's like a little bizarre on top of already being bizarre, but with the small font and the hiding it and folding it and taping it.
So there are, as we mentioned, a lot of theories online about the note. The Unsolved Mysteries co-creator spoke with Allison about a theory which they pointed out similarities between Ray's death and a movie called The Game, which Ray mentioned in the note. The co-creator said, I spoke to Allison about that. She spent a lot of time with the note, as did the FBI, just going through the note to figure out if there were any clues. She doesn't place any significance on the movie The Game. She said Ray liked a lot of movies. He was just a guy who was interested in everything. If he'd only ever left just that writing, if it was the only thing that he had ever written randomly, then people would be a little bit more suspect, but he apparently did this all the time. He kept so many journals full of random writing. Allison feels that she's been trying to go through all the journals just to find any clue about what would help her, and she couldn't find any real or strong connections to The Game. So if you're not familiar with that movie, which I feel like I watched it forever ago, but it starred Michael Douglas, and this is the IMDb bio. It says, after a wealthy San Francisco banker is given an opportunity to participate in a mysterious game, his life is turned upside down as he begins to question if it might really be a concealed conspiracy to destroy him, which I do find interesting because he speaks a lot about The Game, like the game is over, and you know, now, and he mentions The Game movie specifically. Like, it's kind of an interesting theory. I do agree.
And I saw another comment, and I think it's interesting that they're just like, has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Because I saw another comment, I've never seen the movie, but someone wrote, one of these movies was The Game. Immediately I thought, of course, there's one big scene at the end of the movie where the main character jumped off the roof of a fancy hotel and goes through the glass roof. The similarities to Ray are truly astonishing. The whole movie is about this crazy game that a company arranges to make you think you have to lose everything, that makes you think you lose everything in order to let you appreciate life again. Ray was an unsuccessful movie scriptwriter, and maybe he got involved. Maybe he tried to imitate The Game in some way, or maybe he was having like mental health issues and somehow kind of thought that plot was happening in his life, since it seems like he potentially had a stressful job, even if he wasn't working for Porter Stansberry anymore. It just seems like he was in a high pressure job situation. But I do think it's interesting that, like, the character in the movie did basically the same exact thing.
I'm just looking at the note again. Like, so it starts with, that was a well-played game. Then he goes on to say about memberships during the game, well done to everyone who participated. Like, it's a very theme. The note is themed along the lines of there being some game played with participants.
So maybe he like really thought he was in it and like this note was supposed to be found like after he completed the game, after he jumped off or something.
And even part of the bit that was unable to be read, like one line that can be read, it says, helps give meaning to the game. So, yeah, an interest. I feel like that is a very plausible and interesting theory.
And I think it's really interesting how Allison and Unsolved Mysteries are just like, meh. Like.
I'd love to read. Like, I am, I don't know. Allison is very forward in this case. Like, she appeared in Unsolved Mysteries. She's spoken a lot about Ray over the years. I don't think she's ever remarried, but I would be interested to know why she hasn't released some of his journals. Maybe she just wants to keep them private, but I feel like if he did write books and books and books of his thoughts, maybe there could be something that could hold information about what happened.
You'd think so. I feel like she does also struggle from confirmation bias, like most people, where maybe she picks and chooses what she wants to share because of if and she believes like something specific. Yeah, I feel like that's totally normal to do. I'm not trying to like
say
it in a bad way. But just like if she thinks one thing happened and that's truly what she believes, obviously that's the information she's going to want to share. And also maybe just on top of wanting to like protect his privacy to some extent.
So some media have also analyzed the notes. This is from WBAL-TV and I just found this article quite interesting. So they note that the note, they note the note, began and ended with phrases used in the Masonic order. So as we mentioned earlier, Ray purchased the book about Freemasons. He also called them before his death. The Baltimore police commander, Fred Field, said, based on what we've seen, his interest in the Masonic order was not to do charitable work. Somehow it was linked to his interest in the movie industry and this theory that somehow there was control being exerted by the Masonic order. So Allison said, because the note was so weird, I just took that first sentence and laid it into Google and the first thing that came up was Freemasons. So as we mentioned, basically it's a secret society. They would hold elaborate secret ceremonies. And it was interesting that he bought the book. He called them for a reportedly long phone call before his death. I do feel like for me personally, I feel like he just maybe had some type of fascination with the organization and he was very interested in it.
Or maybe research for a script he was writing.
Yeah,
or maybe
also could have been.
Or maybe just mental illness.
Yeah. So I guess the two main theories in this, or three I guess, could be that suicide, the second one was maybe it was some type of accidental death by Ray, or the third one is that there is some type of cover-up, maybe by Porter Stansberry or related people, maybe the participants of the game. One of Ray's friends, Brad Hotman, spoke after the Unsolved Mysteries episode aired, and he basically insinuated that Ray had been struggling with his mental health. He said, this is a real conversation the world can have about mental illness and the help people need when they – and the help – and help people get help when they need it. Unsolved Mysteries turned it into a murder mystery where they're accusing people of being involved. Some interesting things I found online is that Ray apparently had no reported problems with his mental health and that he was extremely afraid of heights, which kind of goes back to the accident theory. I don't think this was an accident. I personally think this was some type of mental health crisis. I don't know if he meant to kill himself, but I feel like he absolutely jumped off the roof into the conference room, whether or not, I don't know what he thought the outcome was going to be or if it was a suicide attempt, but I personally think this was a mental health crisis that caused his death.
Yeah, I agree.
Like a lot of people do go into the Porter Stansberry cover up, maybe, like I just can't even, I don't even know what he would have been covering up though. Like maybe one thing I did find interesting is that after Ray's death, Porter Stansbury was ordered to pay $1.5 million in restitution for providing false stock information in the financial newsletter that the company made. So as we mentioned, Ray was part of a newsletter. I don't know if it was the one that Porter Stansbury ended up being fined for, but just kind of an interesting note. But I just feel like it doesn't seem to me
No motive.
No, like he employed Ray and asked Ray to write the newsletter. I'm assuming he gave Ray the information because Ray doesn't appear to have had any background in stocks. He was a water polo coach and a screenplay writer. So I feel like he gave Ray a job maybe as a favor to try and help him get settled in Baltimore. Didn't work out. Ray left and started to do his own editing and video business. I don't know. I feel like when money is involved, people always think there's some type of cover up. I feel like Porter Stansbury sounds like a bit of a shady person in terms of
just the
his
name.
Financial dealings, but I just don't think he had anything to do with Ray's death. I know we said Ray left the voicemail for him saying, hey, I've got it all figured out or whatever. But I just feel like that could
have... If he was in a mental health
crisis, that's what I was going to say.
It could all just be...
And, you know, nonsense. Porter was his friend. Porter probably tried to protect him. Like, I'm not standing up for Porter. He seems like a bit of a dirtbag anyway. But I just feel like he maybe enabled Ray a little bit. Like, oh, went along with whatever his latest theory was or his latest scheme. Do you know what I mean? Like, even if it was right, look, I'm writing a screenplay about this. I've got it figured out. It could be something along those lines.
Yeah, true. It could have just been like, I got that screenplay figured out or whatever. Yeah.
I feel like if he was trying to hide something from Allison, he wouldn't be leaving voicemails to Porter in the full where she could hear. I know, you know, she said that he didn't want to speak about the friend who died in the car accident, and he wouldn't tell her what he was paranoid and anxious about. But if
some people just don't like talking about their feelings.
Yeah, and if he was that paranoid about Porter doing something to him, I don't think he would have left a message for him while Allison could hear it.
Yeah, I feel like him like not talking about certain things is just, there's a lot of men who feel like they're not allowed to talk about their feelings or they're not allowed to feel sad. Maybe he was struggling with mental illness, but he didn't want to talk about it. He didn't want to be seen as weak, or he didn't want to be seen as like less of a man for struggling with his mental health or even just with anything. Like, a lot of boys were brought up to be like, boys don't cry and stuff like that. So I don't think that's too weird.
I was chatting with one of our people on Instagram today, and we said we're going to do this episode, and this is her thoughts. She said, I can see suicide and murder. I'm literally on the fence. Way too many occurrences prior to his death. I really think someone was after him in some capacity, but did that drive him to jump? His friend that died years prior, and Ray thought that was suspicious, and the wife's friend saw Ray taking the call and running from the house. Like, I feel like this was probably a suicide. And I do agree with what Ray's friend said, that maybe Unsolved Mysteries and kind of the online speculation has turned it into more of a mystery than what it is, which is someone who was just struggling and was not well.
Yeah, because, you know, murder mystery is more fun than just a sad suicide.
Yeah.
I'm saying that, like, sarcastically. But that's how it is. Like, that's what people sensational. Yeah, like, I'm just trying to say, like, people sensationalize that. Obviously, if it's a suicide and we're like, oh, he was mentally ill, you're not getting like a Netflix show about that. Yeah. You're going to get a Netflix show about this weird unsolved murder that maybe had to do with all these rich people and the Freemasons and blah, blah, blah. Like, that is more sensationalized.
And we're still here talking about it almost 2006. So nearly, you know, we're a few years off 20 years. I even saw that someone's making a documentary on this called Ravenge, like revenge, but Ravenge.
Oh my God.
Like, people are still talking about it. It is very mysterious, but I feel like a lot of the mystery comes from the letter. And if that hadn't have been found or wasn't made public, people would be more accepting to believe that this was probably some type of suicidal mental health crisis and there was nothing more to it.
Yeah. And just as a side note, I did want to actually like see more about what Freemasons are and what they do. So I found, not to talk about Reddit again, I feel like we've talked about Reddit a lot, but someone on Explain Like I'm Five, what are Freemasons? What do they actually do? Why are they so proud of being Freemasons? And someone said, I'm currently worshipful master of my lodge. Like everyone else here has pointed out, most of our meetings consist of planning our charitable work and general business. In parentheses, paying bills, building maintenance, and routine stuff. However, we do a lot of other awesome stuff. We report every meeting on sick or financially troubled brothers and have a fund set up to assist when we can. We check in on our deceased brothers' widows to see if we can assist in any way or simply talk to them. We provide scholarships to local high schools. We're the largest volunteer of both money and time to the Special Olympics. We tend to have this reputation of this highly secret society that runs the world, thanks to Hollywood and Nicolas Cage. But truth be told, we're mostly a bunch of old dudes who are simply looking to get out of the house a couple of nights a month. We just happen to do some good while at it. And someone else said, my dad and brother are both Freemasons. From what I've been able to get out of them, they just do a lot of charity work. It's basically a men's club with some ceremonial stuff thrown in. They also hold a lot of fundraisers for local and UK charities. They really do look after their members as well. Back in 2013, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. At the time, he was the Grand Master Apprentice or something like that. He spent 9 months in the hospital, fell behind on mortgage payments, car payments, and his wife was struggling with hospital parking fees and petrol. The whole lodge band together and paid his outstanding mortgage payments in 3 months in advance. Debts he fell behind on, paid for gas and his wife's parking fees, and held a fundraiser for Cancer Research UK.
Maybe that's just what they want you to believe. I'm joking. Well, yeah,
then someone else did comment. They're like, that's exactly what the Freemasons want you to think. This is, you expect me to trust a Freemason to tell me that the Freemasons aren't running the world?
It's funny because while you were speaking, I was just Googling too. There's a lot of books that do lump the Freemasons with the Illuminati. There's one called Secret Societies, Illuminati, Freemasons, and the French Revolution. it's a very diverse book. I feel like it's one of the secret societies that people don't really understand much about, and because of that it seems very mysterious. Maybe it is really mysterious and we'll never know.
Like, are women not allowed to join?
It doesn't sound like they are. I don't know.
Is that sexist? Is that discriminatory? Excuse me, because I was gonna be like, the only way we could find out is if I join. That's why they don't want the girls to join, because we love to gossip. Anyways, not to get too off topic, but I agree. Seems like he was struggling mentally.
It sounds like, too, he had a lot of stress. Off the roof. Like, he started his business. They were trying to sell the house, trying to move back across the country, had a lot of financial debt. Like, there was a lot going on just in a normal life, plus mental health issues. Just might have all been too much for him.
And probably after starting his own business, he probably felt a lot of pressure to write like a good screenplay. And I know nothing gives you writer's block more than feeling like high pressure, everything depends on it.
Definitely.
That could be where that note kind of came from too. So that is everything for this episode. Let us know what your theories are on this case. We'll post on Instagram. So if you want to leave a comment with what you think, that'd be cool. And like we said, everything will be on the blog. We'll have all of our sources and everything on there at truecrimesocietyblog.com. And follow us on Instagram at True Crime Society. Like I said, we'll do a post there so everyone can share what they think. And we're always posting updates there on the current cases that everyone is following. If you want to follow our personal accounts, mine is stephsum_Olivia's TCS Olivia. If you want to see what we're up to. And check us out on Patreon. We do weekly bonus episodes there, so a whole nother episode a week. Everything is ad-free on there, and I release these episodes a day earlier. And we have some fun chats and stuff on there, too, and it's a very reasonable price, so check us out there. It's always linked in the episode description of the episodes, so go click that right now and check it out. And just the usual stuff, share the podcast. It's a huge, huge help to us when you guys share the podcast to like your Instagram stories or something, because it gets the word out. There's so many true crime podcasts. So how are people supposed to find us? By you guys sharing. So it's a great, free, easy way to support us. And we love when you guys do that. That's it. Thank you guys for listening. Stay safe. Peace out.
See you next time.
done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.